talk a little bit about myths.
Uh-huh.
And creating new myths. Lovecraft was one of the first people to start this in horror, creating the Cthulhu mythos.
Yeah.
Tell us about your attempts to create a new myth.
I would not, Rick, honestly, claim to attempt something so ambitious as that. I'm not even sure it's even possible. I think what you can do is you can put a fresh twist on something that's already there. But I think that over the whatever 2,500 years that we've been telling stories to one another about the gods and the demons and the interplay between the evil and good forces, spirits which exercise their powers over us, I think just about every piece of mythology has been touched upon one way or another. So my thing isn't really, I would not be so arrogant, I guess, to say, oh, well, I'm really trying to create a new myth here. What I'm trying to do is make something fresh for people. So that, for instance, I did a book called Weave World, which was about a world which was woven into a carpet. And to be hidden, a world which was a magical world, which was under threat from a force which thought it was one of God's avenging angels. It turns out not to be one of God's avenging angels, but it certainly thinks it is. And so these magical creatures weave themselves into this carpet, thinking that they will sort of hide out for a period of time, and the hero at the beginning of the novel falls into this carpet and sort of discovers the life inside it. And the book is published, I don't know, in 17 or 18 languages, I think, and it's about to become a miniseries on Showtime. And it's one of those myths which I didn't invent, but I kind of put a half new twist on. The idea of the hidden world is as old as Olympus. The idea that some creatures, magical, special, possessed of divine or semi-divine powers, are just waiting around the corner if we just knew which corner to turn. Are ideas which have haunted the imaginations of little kids and adults forever, I think. What I was trying to do with the carpet thing was say, well, here's a new twist on that. Here's a carpet. And a carpet is something you stand on all the time, and so therefore it's right there in front of you. And I think it made the idea a little bit more domestic, frankly. And so it was tremendous. It's tremendous fun to be able to do that, to be able to give people. I did a book for children called The Thief of Always, which is a book about a kid, an irritated, unhappy kid who gets seduced away to a house where it's spring in the morning and it's high summer around noon and then into the afternoon and then around 5 in the evening the Halloween, the trees start to fill with burning pumpkins and Halloween comes to the house, and by midnight it's Christmas and the snow falls and you fall asleep happily with a present, and the following morning it's spring again. And this boy Harvey is happy, happy, happy in this place until he realizes this is a price to pay for being there. Now that isn't a new myth, it's Faust.
And it's Rip Van Winkle.
And it's Rip Van Winkle, exactly right. And it's probably 10 other things. But there's a little bit of a half twist on it. And that's all I really want to be able to do. I want to be able to make the thing new. And one of the things that, honestly, the greatest joys for me is that book is I think there's probably 1.5 million in print in America, and it's taught in schools. And one of the wonderful things about that is doing a signing tonight, and there'll be somebody there with a bashed copy of this book, and they'll say, this is the first book I read. This is the first book that managed to get me reading. And for me, that's great because, and I was on Dennis Miller's show on Friday, and I was talking backstage. Unfortunately, Dennis, I didn't get much of a chance to talk about it live. Something interesting has happened, not just here in America, but also around the world of late. Children have started to read again.
Yes, and that's you're working on that as well.
I'm working on that, and thank the Lord, so is J.K. Rowling. Philip Pullman with his work, with his wonderful his dark materials, that trilogy. I mean, it's amazing to see, because I think probably if we'd been sitting here 10 years ago, we probably would have been pretty pessimistic about the prospect of children moving into the new millennium as readers. But I'm finding everywhere that, including my own daughter, the daughter that I'm, my stepdaughter, my husband's daughter, Nicole, I mean, she has been through the game stage. She did the games, and now she's reading. And I never thought this was going to happen, and I think we have a huge amount to thank Harry Potter for, and a lot of other people too. And I think we have to thank the internet as well, curiously, because you communicate on the internet in words.
Yes, it's internet is a reading experience.
It's a reading and a writing experience.
Yes, which is even better for
our
kids.
Completely. And so I feel as though something really rather wonderful is going on out there.
I wanted to ask you, genre fiction, one of the joys of it is that it allows you to externalize the interior.
Sure.
Horror fiction, you externalize your fears.
Mm-hmm.
Fantasy, your hopes,
mm-hmm.
and your joys. I'm wondering if you could talk about how you moved from horror fiction to fantasy fiction, and talk a little bit about the onset from, take us from Weave World and the Damnation Game to Aberrat.
Well, you know, firstly, I think I've always written a little bit of both. I think there's always been an element of fantasy in my horror, and I think there's always been an element of horror in my fantasy. Weave World has some pretty scary things in it. Even Thief of Always, we were talking about before, has some scary stuff in there. And Magicka, which is probably my favorite of my adult books for adults, has some very, very dark material in it.
And some very beautiful material.
And,
it was a wonderful combination of wonder and terror.
And now for me, you see, you've just described my perfect read. And you've also just described the Bible.
There you go.
I mean, I think that the Bible is the model. Rick is giving me a panicked look here, like, don't go there, Barker, don't go there. No, I think the Bible is an amazing model for us in terms of giving us, going back to this idea of an extensive menu of commandments and stories and histories and scary stuff. You read Revelations recently.
No,
you know?
But it's scary, yeah.
Yeah. Not a lot of jokes, I grant you, but poetry, amazing poetry. Song of Solomon, amazing eroticism. And I think, you know, what I always find funny when you hear some of the more fundamentalist guys ranting as though the Bible were their own private possession. They seem to have forgotten all the bits of the Bible that don't suit them, including the erotic elements, you know. So I feel as though I've always tried to mingle elements, but as I moved into my middle 40s, early 40s, actually, I went to HarperCollins, my publishers, and I said, you know, I want to do some books about an invented world which will do for me what C.S. Lewis had done for him when he gave us Narnia. I wanted to find a world where I could put all my dreams and some of the dark stuff, a lot of the bright stuff, some funny stuff, some weird dreams, and just wanted to do that. And they said no. They said, no, you're doing very well. You're making us a lot of money. Don't go spoiling it and, you know, changing, you know, horses yet again, because I had gone from horror to writing fantasy. Now, here was me saying I wanted to go and write for children. And I was frustrated. And I had built myself a place to paint at home. And I started to pick up oil paints, which I had never done before, and I started to paint. And I started to paint without really thinking what I was painting. Paul Klee, the Belgian painter, says drawing is taking a line for a walk, which I think is an amazing phrase.
It's a wonderful phrase.
It's a great phrase. And painting for me is pretty similar kind of thing. I mean, I don't really know what I don't know where I'm going to go. I'm just going to walk. And so the canvases in A Magicka, and there's 105 in the first book, 125 in the second book, are...
Aberrat, you mean?
Aberrat, what did I say?
I'm sorry.
A Magicka, my apologies. Yes, Aberrat, exactly. In the two Aberrat books are... those paintings begin with you know, me picking up some orange and seeing where the orange wants to go. And after I had about 220, 230 of these paintings, and as we discussed before we came on the air, some of them are very big. I mean, the biggest of them is 27 feet long. I actually went to New York and I said, I want you guys to come and look at something. Don't be judgmental about it. Just come and look. So an amazing lady called Joanna Kotler, who has her own imprint at HarperCollins and publishes a lot of wonderful people, Jamie Lee Curtis amongst them, and came out to L.A. And I said, okay, just come into my studio. And there were 250 paintings. And I said,
that's a big studio.
Yeah, what it did.
20-foot paintings.
Yeah, well, so it was actually spread not just through the studio, but actually outside into the garden and everywhere. It was everywhere I could put paintings. She said, well, what is this? And I said, well, I don't really know. I know it's called Aberrat. I've decided to call it Aberrat. I don't really know what the stories are yet because I haven't started to write them because you haven't told me I can. But I'm going to, and I really want to tell these stories, and I really want the paintings to lead me to the stories. In other words, I want to invert what is the conventional structure, which is, you know, you write the story, you give it to an illustrator, or perhaps you give it to yourself to illustrate, and somebody then makes the paintings. Here I was making the paintings and letting the paintings dictate what the story was going to be. So I've written two of those four books out, a quartet. Second one comes out today. Aberrat, Days of Magic, Nights of War. And it has 125 of those paintings in. There are now 500 of those paintings. And
wow,
yeah, no, it's a lot of paintings.
Is it being exhibited?
Well, we did a limited exhibit in LA, but I haven't sold any of them, And nor is it my intention to sell any of them. I want to hold the collection together at least until I've had time to tour the books, to tour the paintings as extensively as I can. And Disney's bought the rights to the movies. And
tell us a little bit about the scenes with Disney and DreamWorks touring your house.
Well, that was very fun because, you know, I'm lucky enough. I have three houses in a row. I bought a house. I mean, this is just luck, dumb luck. I bought a house, a nice house in L.A. in a quiet neighborhood, and the house beside it, which was pretty much a wreck of a house, went on sale, and I thought, boy, if I don't buy this, I'm going to have neighbors. So I bought it, and a few years later, the house on the other side of the of me went on sale. So I did the same thing. So I have the three houses in a row. So I now have a house which is just paintings, and everywhere you go. I mean, sometimes in some places the paintings are five paintings thick. I mean, they're layered against one another. And there's nothing much you can do about that because, you know, there's a lot of them there. But my agent said, you know, we need to show this to the studios. And I said, well, the only way to really do that is to bring the studios to us because I can't take these paintings anyplace. And I said, I don't think they're going to do that. And he said, I think they will. And he said, because I think this is the first time they've ever heard somebody say, come and look at my etchings. You know?
I can't believe that's the first time.
Well, for some of them, I believe me, I think it's the first time. So they, Jeffrey Katzenberg came up, and some of the Disney folks came up, and John Calley came up, who was then running Sony, and it was wonderful because the house is, I mean, there is no square inch of wall visible. It is just color everywhere. You've seen the paintings. I mean, they're densely colored, but they're also densely painted, Rick. They're in pasto. There's paint on paint on paint so that, you know, the paint almost casts a shadow. I mean, there's that much thickness of paint. And so it was wonderful. I mean, people that I was frankly very nervous of, like Jeffrey Katzenberg, who I have immense respect for, but I'm also nervous of, came in, loosened his tie, sat cross-legged in the middle of the floor on the carpet that I had used. Interestingly, as a nice aside, the carpet that I had used is the inspiration for the carpet for Weave World. Sat in the middle of that carpet and said, so tell me the story. And the effect that the paintings had was nice. It was, these are very powerful men.
That's great. Now, one of the things about the Aberrat books that I really love is that your publisher has put in a lot of money to make those beautiful books. The paintings are perfectly reproduced.
Yeah.
It's heavy paper.
Yeah.
How did you ask for that, or did they volunteer that?
God bless them. Joanna Kotler volunteered that. She said, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this like art books. These are going to be like old-fashioned books, the way books used to be. And, because they're oil paintings, because, frankly, I'm not an illustrator, I'm not experienced in this, I had no... I have no sense of, I haven't painted any of these paintings to fit a particular page size or anything like that. I was just painting. So when Joanna, took this on board, she was taking on, as she saw it, a novel project, in the sense that I was writing, I think the first book is 105,000 words, and the second book is 125,000 words. So they're big books. But they also have a lot of paintings in their art books. And she said, I'm treating these like art books. And, Yet, she's brought them in at an amazing price. I mean, I think, you know, you can probably find these in certain bookstores for, I don't know, $16-$17, which I think is pretty amazing.
It's amazing for how many pages they are and how much color
there is. And yeah, and I hope that these will be the kinds of books that kids will say, I want to see more paintings. Show me paintings, Mom and Dad. Not Bach's paintings. Paintings. Take me to a gallery. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of miraculous things which are in art galleries which kids just don't get to see anymore. And I think that's a thing that families could do. And the wonderful thing about painting and the word, of course, is that it's interactive. It's not, you know, you go and stand in front of, a Gauguin or a Van Gogh or whatever. The story isn't immediately in front of you. You kind of have to, find the story for yourself. You have to tell it to yourself or tell it to each other. It's a wonderful, it's been a wonderful experience to be able to do that and to find that the paintings have given people such pleasure.
I wanted to talk a little bit about these books. The prose in them is remarkable.
Thank
because
you.
they're long books.
Yeah.
But they read just incredibly fast. They're really fun and easy to read, but yet they don't feel dumbed down.
Right.
How did you do that as a writer? How did you approach this project in a way that was different maybe from other stuff you've done?
Yeah, I mean, there were a bunch of things I wanted to do. Clearly, there were going to be no cuss words in this book. There was going to be nothing sexy in this book. And there was going to be violence of a very, very minor kind in this book. And those were the rules. Those were the things I was not going to shift from because these books were going to be read by 9-10-year-olds and upward. And so I needed to, at the same time, find a kind of luxury in the language. You know, Ray Bradbury was one of the first people who introduced me to this idea. The words had this kind of beautiful, cadence, you know. When there's one of his books called Silver Apples of the Moon, Golden Apples of the Sun, which is actually a Yeats poem. Two lines from a Yeats poem. And when I found the Yeats poem, which is amazing, it was a revelation to me because here was Bradbury had led me to Yeats, who was going to lead me to a bunch of other Irish poets and so on and so forth. And I think that's what words do, beautiful words do. They make you look at the world differently, and they make you look at the way you use words differently. You know, one of the sadder things, and earlier in this conversation, we were celebrating the use of words on the internet. No question, it's really great that young people are using the internet to communicate, but it is debased language. It is language which is spelt wrongly, and it's very often overly simplistic, you know. And what I'm trying to say is, hey, I'm going to give you some difficult words, but they're going to sound great. And because they sound great, I remember my father coming in one time and saying to me, what does verisimilitude mean? And I thought, and I was probably about, 11, verisimilitude. And I said, why do you want to know, Dad? He said, because I didn't know. And I'm trying to know, figure out whether you know. And I thought verisimilitude, verify, comes from verify. Yeah, I said it's something to do with truth. It's something to do with the similarity to truth. Similitude, verify, which is what it was. I kind of worked it out. I didn't get it completely right. But I remember the look on my dad's face. was one of, my dad was a hard man, and a hard man to impress. And I remember him clocking that I was smarter than he thought I was. And I think that the use of words, I think it's great if you can give people the music of words. I've put some poems in. I've invented some poems. There's a poem at the beginning of the first book, which is a rather depressing poem in a way. It goes, drown the crew. How does it go? Have you got the poem right there? Have you got the book right there? The first book. You don't have it. Yeah, give it to me. Let me read it to you. Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you. Here we go. You can cut the dead air out of that, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's why we have these fabulous digital tools.
Absolutely. Right. Life is short and pleasures few, and hold the ship and drown the crew. But oh, how very blue the sea is. And I love that poem because it's such a simple little idea, you know? Life is short and pleasures are few, and hold, there's a hole in the ship, and the crew are drowned. But oh, how very blue the sea is. And there's a painting above the poem of a sailor sitting on a ship going down, looking at a blue sea. And poems can have that effect upon me. They can, and somebody was kind enough to say recently, actually it was Cornelia Funke who wrote The Thief Lord and Inkheart, wonderful, wonderful books for kids. And she said how much she liked the poems. There aren't many of them. There's like four or five in each book. But it's another way to draw people, children particularly, into the words and into the magic of the words and into the rhythm of the words. Words are incantations, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And I love the idea of them being used more liberally and more creatively than I think our present generation is. I think it would be lovely if you know, kids were taking some of the words that they were having to figure out in Aberat, maybe with a dictionary by a side, no problem with that. And then, you know, finding a way to use them in their own language, because the more words you have to say, the more words you have to express things with, firstly, the better you are at expression. And the better you are at saying, I love you, the better you are at saying, this is why I hate you. It's very important to have as broad a cross-section, I believe, of words as possible. And so that's one of the ways that I've tried to make the music, the words sing a little bit in the Aberat books.
You now have a family.
Yes.
How does having a family and having children, how does that change you as a writer and as a filmmaker and as an artist?
It's a big one, this one. Luckily, it's just one. because it's a big responsibility. Nick is 16, and she's a beautiful, beautiful 16-year-old lady, young lady. And I'm fearful for her all the time. And I was never, you know, I never had that before, even though I'd had partners before. They were roughly my equal. David, Nick's dad, my husband is 40 this year. I'm 51. We share pretty much equally the parenting issues in the house. Though Nick isn't always with us. Some of the time she's with her mom. But I'm afraid for her in a way that I was never afraid for myself, though probably my parents were afraid for me. You know, it's a bad world, and it's a worse world than it used to be. And again, that's how I think words can be useful. And that's how I think articulation can be useful. It's one of the things I despise about. Can I be political just for a moment?
Oh, absolutely.
I despise about Bush is his inability to use words in anything but the most simplistic of fashions. I mean, it's embarrassing to hear a man who is, you know, supposed to be. And his dad was pretty darn articulate, but this guy, I mean. It's embarrassing. I mean, and I'm not a great Kerry freak either, because I think he's a cold fish. But you know, I prefer an articulate cold fish to a dumb warm one.
The main character in Aberrat is Candy Quackenbush.
Yeah.
You've modeled her a bit after Nicole, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Well, you know, it's been interesting watching how feisty a 16-year-old, well, she wasn't 16 when I started these stories. I mean, I started painting these paintings almost 10 years ago now. And so I started them even before I knew David.
Mm-hmm.
But then when Nicole did come into my life, she was 7. And she was feisty at 7, and I watched her grow up, and I watched her be difficult, and I watched her stand her ground, and I watched her, you know,
talk back.
Oh my God, did she talk back? But I also, you know, we have 5 dogs, and at one point she liberated the male rats with the female rats. For us over a period, we had like 42 rats. And she claimed it was an accident, you know, but, you know, who knows? She tried to hide the tribe of newly borns from me for a little while. And at one point I was why are you keeping me away from that end of the cage? And I went to that end of the cage and I thought, oh my God, this is 20 rats here that I didn't know we had. And she looked at me and said, hey, Dad, number two. She calls me Dad, number two. Hey, Dad, number two. Yeah, you see what happened was the boy got in with the girl. I said, yeah, I know how those things work. But, you know, we also have parrots and cockatiels. And she's amazing with the animals. She's wonderful with the animals, which is very important to me. Because I think if you can be good with animals and tender with animals, then you can be tender with the human animal. Her boyfriend's a very respectful of her, and actually of us too, young man, and I like him immensely. It's been a learning curve. It's been, you know, learning not to be angry when it was useless to be angry, learning to be articulate when I was angry, you know?
Yeah, it's difficult to learn to talk to your kids.
Yeah. For one thing, you're learning another language.
Yes.
I mean, you're learning a, you know, generational language, and I'm sort of 10 years older than her dad naturally would be, if you will,
mm-hmm.
you know. And for a period of time, I was also kind of laying down the law a little bit because David was away a lot, and I had to do a lot of laying down of the law. And I would hate, you know, I would lose it, and then I would hate myself for it. I'd feel really bad about my, you know, about the, you know, it's such a complicated issue. It's so complicated. You want to do your best, and what is doing your best? You never know until you see the results. And what I'm seeing now is our David and I's beautiful 16-year-old, you know, turning into an articulate princess. That's as much as I can ask.
One of the aspects of your fiction, and especially of Aberrat, that I really like, is that evil in the guise, especially of Christopher Carrion, is tragic.
Yeah.
And it hasn't always been that way you. I mean, Rawhead Rex was a killing machine.
Yeah.
Talk about that transformation for you as a writer and as an artist.
Well, at one point in one of my books, I wrote the line that all evil comes from a lack of love. And I don't know, the line comes in a magicka. I don't know what my thought process was at the time. I don't know why I wrote that, what experience I was having at the time. It's 12 years ago. But it remained with me, that idea that you if you know love and if you are loved, then you can empathize. And if you can empathize, then you really can't be evil. Because it's evil comes from an incapacity to empathize, to be compassionate, to see the world through somebody else's skin. It's one of the reasons why evil regimes, turn minorities into less than human, if they possibly can, in their language, in their propaganda. The Jew becomes an animal. So therefore you can apply the final solution. This isn't a human being. It's vocabulary. It's back to the word again, isn't it? And, the same with gay men and women. When the Reverend Phelps held up the sign at Matthew Shepard's funeral that said Matthew Shepard burns in hell in front of his mother and father. I have to assume, for the sake of Phelps's soul, that he did not believe that Matthew Stewart was Shepherd was a human being on the same level that he, the Reverend Phelps, was a human being. And so what I'm trying to do now, as I write about my villains, is I'm trying to say, particularly when writing for younger audiences, I'm trying to say, look, these are screwed up people. They're not abstract villains. They're not Moff Tarkin from the first Star Wars movie, where the immortal Peter Cushing plucking at his little lip as he thinks about destroying planets. Even Lucas gets that, doesn't he? Because in the first Star Wars movie, the movement of Darth Vader is towards humanity.
Sure, he becomes human, human by the end of the story.
Right, and I know a lot of people who think that that's a terrible, terrible thing, that it bases the series, and I think it's actually one of the things which elevates the series. And I think that we have to look always, however hard it is. I'm interrupting myself. I got a letter, an incredibly moving letter from a lady whose son is in Iraq at the moment, serving in Iraq. And I had written a letter to him, telling him how proud I was that he was doing his service, and that, I'd sent some books for him to be awaiting him on his return. And his mother wrote me a lovely letter thanking me for the books, and said that her son was presently watching over the man-eating lions that Saddam Hussein's son had kept for the devouring of failed Olympians from Iraq.
Wow.
You got that sentence right?
Yes. That's pretty scary.
That's terrifying. Now, it's really hard to find the humanity in that, right?
No,
It's really, really hard to find, where the hell is the humanity in this man? Where is it? And you just want to hate. I mean, I do. I own up. I just want to hate this guy. Mm-hmm. I'm glad he's dead, But another part of me, I suppose the artist part of me, says, But I also need to understand. Because if you don't understand, you know, it'll repeat itself. If you don't figure out why it happened once, it'll happen again.
Absolutely.
And so one of the things that I try and do in the books I write is set the mystery, the curiosity of villainy into the audience's head, particularly the younger reader's head, so that you see sometimes, for instance, Mr. Hood in Thief of Always is a lonely old bastard. He's a lonely, cold, frigid, empty hearted thing. No, that's not right. Not thing. There, you see, I'm doing it. I'm not
an object.
I'm not allowing him his humanity. Yes, exactly. I'm objectifying him. An empty-hearted man. And I think we're tussling right now as a culture with how we deal with villainy. Because part of us, and I completely understand this, wants to say, you know, somebody who kills children, somebody who feeds people to lions, for God's sake. Well, why should I bother with even trying to understand who that person was? You know? And there's a part of me which completely goes along with that and says, yeah, you know, you're right, why bother? And there's another part of me that thinks, well, unless we bother, we'll never fix it.
Sure, that person was once somebody's child.
Well, that person was, you know, Saddam Hussein's child, and we know why Saddam Hussein's child ended up like that.
Yeah, not a surprise.
Yeah, not a big surprise. There's a short poem in Weave World, the agony of families is not congenital disease, but feet that follow where the foot that has preceded them was put. In other words, the real horror is when one foot just goes exactly where dad's foot went, particularly if dad's foot went in a bad place. And you got to learn to break the cycles. And the only way you break the cycles, I think, is by understanding the cycles. So in my little ways, I'm saying, you know, Christopher Carrion, this villain, is a bad, screwed up man. And let's see if we can understand how he comes to be who he is before he has too many detrimental effects upon the world. Let's put it that way.
What I really liked was that you did that, but you didn't overdo it.
No,
you really made the decision on had.
Yeah, I
mix the good and the bad, yeah, just in the right proportion, so
and
that
you leave it to the audience a little bit, right?
Right. Yeah, you didn't spell it every out. It wasn't a psychoanalytic.
Right.
Here's this.
Yeah, and I also think, honestly, Rick, you know, to be perfectly blunt, as a storyteller, you've still got to hate the villain.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, I still gotta have that moment where I go, yeah, get that son of a gun. So I mean, it's a balancing act that you're trying for constantly.
I wonder if you would want to talk a little bit about yourself as a writer, as a witness to the world and how you report back.
Well, I think there are places where I've done that. I mean, in Sacrament, which is a book which had a gay character, a gay hero.
Mm-hmm.
Was written after the death of my cousin at the age of 30 from AIDS, and very much had the issue of my witnessing the death of many people from AIDS. I think it's a balancing act again. I mean, I seem to have talked a lot about balancing act this afternoon, but I think I'm a Libra and I think I'm supposed to think about balancing act. But I think some of it is about me wanting to, yes, witness, and yet context the witnessing in an invented place so that it never seems, going back to what you were saying earlier about what I did with Carrion, it never seems too, you're never too heavy-handed. You know, part of the fun of this is that the audience won't feel lectured to. The last thing I want in all the world is for an audience to pick up Aberrad or any of my other books and feel like, oh, God, somebody's wagging their finger at me. You know, my job is to give people pleasure. And if they pick up Aberrad and it's full of color and fun and scares and, you know, has a little bit of something to take away with you as well, well, man, that would be great. But I'm not going to, absolutely not going to make somebody pay for the, you know, pay for the error of buying my book. I want people to have fun. I want people to have as much fun as I can give them and in as many ways as I can give it.
That really comes across in Aberrad. It's such a riot.
Yeah,
there you color go. And variety and oddness and strangeness.
Yeah, yeah.
I got to ask you a little bit. I just talked to China Mieville.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of his favorite things, and one of my favorite things about his books and your books, are the monsters.
Right. Well,
tell me how you went from being maybe as a kid afraid of monsters,
right,
to loving the monster but still being afraid.
Well, first thing I want to say is China gave the first Aberrad book my favorite review. I mean, China was amazing in the sense that he gave a review of the Guardian to the book, which made me cry. Because it's just like, because these books take a long time to do. I mean, there's a lot of painting and a lot of writing, and, you know, it's a long journey. And China wrote this review, and it's the only time I've ever written a fan letter to a reviewer. And I wrote and I said, you know, I don't know about the protocol about this. I don't know if I'm even supposed to do this, but thank you, because you completely got what I was up to. And actually, now I'm writing an introduction to one of his books, so that's kind of nice. But I think that the journey that you take as a writer from the simple idea to the riot, if you will, is one which is very different for me from the way I think it is in China's books. I mean, how did he describe his process?
He just said that for him it was all about the monsters.
You see, for me, it's all about making the paintings and then reading whether the paintings are monstrous or not. Or, you know, like there's a character in Aberrad 2 called Limanval, and he has three mouths. And he's lined with yellow teeth, and he speaks to insects because this complexity of labial arrangements allows him to make kind of insecty kind of noises. And the painting sort of taught me that. And so this goes back to, you know, again, taking a line for a walk. I never think, boy, I'm going to make a monster now.
Interesting.
I just think I'm going to make a painting and let's see where we go. And sometimes the paintings, you know, look like, for instance, now, and, you know, it's also in the eye of the beholder. This is also an interesting point. There's a character called John Mischief in the two books. And John Mischief lives with his seven brothers who sprout as separate heads on his two antlers and are also all called John something, which makes for interesting conversations. And the eight Johns, the picture of them is the second painting that I made of the 500. And I know people who look at that painting and think it's a monster. And I look at it and I just, he just smiles at me.
Yeah, he's one of the most enjoyable characters in the
book. You see, there you go. So it's in the eye of the beholder, I think. You know, I mean, I think that when China writes monsters, I mean, you pretty much know. Because they do terrible things. And
Inventively.
Very often they don't look monstrous. I mean, you know, he's very good at making sure there isn't that neat little alignment of the monstrous appearance and the monstrous act. As we all know, beautiful people are capable of doing very horrible things, and some of the most loving and adorable people in my life are people who are not going to win any beauty pageants. You know, so I think it's, we got to look, it's all in the eyes. You know, you said at the very beginning of this, a couple of hours ago, you said, something about the paintings having the life in the eyes. And I think it's in the eyes. I think once I've painted the eyes in, I pretty much know whether it's going to be a villain or not.
Could you tell us a little bit about what's coming up? I'm particularly interested in the third book of the Arts.
Okay. I have the third book of the Art, I have the second book of Galilee, and I have Aberrat 2 and 3. I've just finished a screenplay for Tortured Souls, which is a movie which I may direct next year for Universal.
Where does that come from?
It comes from a series of toys that I created with Todd McFarlane. And I've had great fun making action figures in the last little while. It's been tremendous fun.
Boy, what a dream for a boy who loves monsters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Tortured Souls is a straightforward horror movie. It's a very scary horror movie, I hope. And I'm thinking I might direct it. I am delivering to HarperCollins early next year a collection of short fiction, which not only puts together some of my fiction, which has not been hitherto collected, pieces that have appeared in various places and have never been put into a single book, but also, and I think more importantly, contains a long short story or long novella in which a character of mine called Harry DeMore, who is a detective.
Supernatural detective.
Exactly. Goes up against a fellow called Pinhead from the Hellraiser movies, and in which, because I may as well tell you this because I've told a couple of other people, Pinhead dies. And it is such a relief to be killing the monkey on my back off that I'm having a fine old time with that. So I'll write that. And then, depending on whether I make the movie or not, if I don't make the movie, then I think it's either Aberrat 3 or it's The Art 3. The Art 3 is a huge book.
So it's still around. I was wondering if it had just kind of faded into the sunset.
No. It's huge. It's huge. It sits like Jabba the Hutt at the back of my head. but no, nothing. You know, these mythologies sometimes are better for sort of leaving them to sort of percolate a little bit. And that's certainly been the case with the art, because the solution to the narrative, it's interesting. We haven't talked about this. Maybe next time we'll talk about this. Okay. But in one sense, I think of narratives as being sort of incredibly elaborate crossword puzzles. There's actually only one solution that fits.
Right. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
A story has to tell itself, and it tells itself in exactly one way.
Yeah, only one way. Absolutely right. And I also tell you something else, which I haven't said on the air yet, so you're hearing it for the first time, or your audience hearing it for the first time. I wrote Avrat 2 in its entirety, wrote it for a year, finished it, was about to send it off, and I did a final reading aloud, because I read my texts aloud to myself mm-hmm. one time before I send it off, which is a piece of advice that I read once from Conrad. Joseph Conrad did that. He said it was a way of getting the sense of the cadence correct. And so I read the Aberrat 2 text through, and I didn't like it. And I called HarperCollins, and I said, you know, I know you've been waiting a year, guys, but I'm ditching this whole thing. I'm throwing this whole thing away.
I can't imagine they were happy to hear that.
It was not a happy conversation, Rick.
It must not have been a happy feeling either.
It was a wretched feeling. It was really the worst week of my creative career. I mean, and here's interesting. I have the same number of paintings as subject matter in this book as in the finished second volume, which you have here, mm-hmm. as I did in the volume that I threw away. But there are no situations in common.
My God, you completely rewrote the entire second novel?
Oh, no, thrown away. There was actually one copy in existence, which is my handwritten draft, but everything else was shredded, you know.
Wow, that must have been tough.
But it goes back to what you were talking about when you were talking about there being one way to tell the story. You see, I hadn't found the one way to tell the story. I'd failed in the crossword. I cheated the crossword, is what I'd done.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it. As soon as I read it, I thought I knew it. And I'm not going to spoil something that I've taken so long. Because I've been painting these pictures for, you know, at that point, I've been painting them for 7 years. And I'm not going to spoil these things. This whole adventure is too important to me. I'm going to go back and start again. And a year later, I delivered a second book to them. Well, actually, yes, there's a second volume, and they never saw the other version, and there's only one in copy in existence, and I know where it is.
That's incredible. We've been talking with Clive Barker. His latest book is Aberrat, Days of Magic, Nights of War. Thanks for joining us, Clive.
Rick, I have to tell you, this has been immense fun. Thank you.
Me too. Thanks.